Yisher kach to the Hornsteins for hosting us. Yisher kach to the Hornsteins for hosting us. Amichai and his wife, Yisher kach. Those who didn't follow, there were two or three classes in halacha that we had over the last 2 months. And a lot of the halachot that people asked were very relevant to the home, so if people didn't catch them, they're online. And we'll begin with the questions that people sent in. First question was, my kids go from Gan, or school, to Tzaharon every day. All the questions were anonymous. I really have no idea who's asking what. My kids go from Gan to Tzaharon every day, except for breakfast and bedtime. I hardly see them. I feel like other people are raising my children, but due to my schedule and commute, there is no other option. How can I still instill good chinuch with them when I only really spend quality time with them on Shabbos? Okay, so the question assumes a reality and then says, okay, what? How do I make the best of this reality? So Rav Bochco told me numerous times that he's very concerned that our generation, in order to balance their budget, very often parents have to be both working. And this is a financial reality on the one hand, but I would say that before we really address the question, we do also have to take a step back and question, are there other options? Meaning this is not the ideal reality. For children to be brought up by someone else is not what we'd like. In a minute we're going to discuss the question that was asked, but before we do, it is good that people take a step back and say, hey, wait a second, I'm only meeting my kids this amount of time per day and then over the Shabbos. And if people reanalyze their lives, so sometimes people can make shifts. In general, if there's a direction that's important to us, then over time we will find a way to get there. Usually things are amorphous, and that's why people never accomplish what they theoretically would like to. But if people define to themselves that one of the things that are important to them is they want to get to a point where they have X, or in this case, they have more time with their kids, then people will find ways to do it. That means maybe people won't volunteer in a chesed committee. Maybe people will juggle their schedules so that they can be at home when the kids are awake and then do some of the work when the kids are sleeping. Maybe people will look for other ways of supplementing their income. But I think that if we recognize that we want to spend a certain amount of time a day with our children, so then we will at least be searching in that direction, and hopefully we will find opportunities and directions where that's possible. Before the question, I'm just saying as a perspective, it definitely is a challenge of our generation, but people have to ask themselves, do I really need two cars? Do I really need... I don't know how many people here own two cars. or one, right? I don't want to give examples that are relevant to us because it's not fair to give examples that are relevant to us. I think that every person has to analyze within their own budget that there might be shifts that would allow them to manage with a different income. So I think this is something to think about in the long term. I'm saying in terms of the time we spend with kids. My Rebbeim believed that mothers, children need more mother time and children need less father time. That a child can be okay with a father that sees him breakfast and supper and over Shabbos and Friday. However, with the mother, you do want more time with your kids, and children learn the concept of rachmanus from a mother, and children learn the most basic concepts of how to be a good human being in society from their mothers, much more than the fathers. If a child loses that structure, so then we have to realize that that's a huge compromise. It's not that it's untenable, but it is a compromise, and it's something to think about to see if we can recapture, to have more time with the kids. And yes, quality time is a major component, which we will discuss, but quantity time also matters. And the idea that mommy is in the next room working is different than the kid is in a tzaron and mommy's not at home at all. The children definitely benefit from the structure of a home. There's a story of a young man who studied philosophy. And when he came to speak to the Rebbe of Chabad, he was enamored by, I don't remember if it was Aristotle or Plato, but the Rebbe of Chabad said to him that his major peeve is the destruction of the family structure within the philosophies. And he stressed the idea that children gain values not through the way we speak, but through the experiences they have in a home. And those values are critical. It's a critical component of what we want to give our children, and that's why it is very important to have time. Now, that being said, again, okay, now we have to deal with the reality the person drew in their question, that they have breakfast and bedtime and Shabbos. Okay, so bedtime. So most parents dread bedtime. It's like the worst part of the day. However, it is also a very important part of the day. If we can approach bedtime calmer and more focused and actually be with the kids, so bedtime can be a time where children not only wind down, but they learn how to look at their day. And imagine a parent has 3 hours with their kids at home, and they say, "What was your day like?" And the kid goes, "Okay," and continues playing. That's reality. The kid's not going to tell you too much about their day during the day. But when they're winding down and they're getting ready for bed, that's the time where very often you can actually hear what happened in their day. We shouldn't look down at bedtime and say, "I only got breakfast and bedtime with the kid." No, you have bedtime. You have one of the most critical hours with your children. So I understand that bedtime is something that parents dread. The looks around here are like, "What bedtime are you living with?" So my children at bedtime also dance around the house. And in all fairness, if we can start bedtime earlier, I know that's hard, but if we can do it at a time where we have the time to talk to the children, one of the things that we learned is to ask children to tell 3 fun things that happened that day. Now, this accomplishes many things. Number one, it gets the kids to be focused on the positive. When you ask a child that question, so they have to think, "What was good in my day today?" So that, in its own right, is very chinuchi. Number two, they start thinking about what happened that day. And then that's going to jog their memory if there are things they wanted to share with you, which they didn't remember by the time they walked through the front door and they were playing around. And even if you ask them what happened during the day, chances are they're not telling you. They're busy. Kids are busy. However, when you ask them to tell you 3 fun things that happened today, so then children will come up with things that suddenly they'll start telling you, "But this wasn't so much fun." And then you get to hear about what their day really was like. Shabbos. So this is tough because if someone's working so hard all week, they want to rest on Shabbos. But if that's the time you have with your kids, so then you have to be completely there on Shabbos. And that sometimes means planning to rest before Shabbos. so that when Shabbos comes, we can be with the kids. I tell husbands that I'm against alcohol at the Shabbos table, even if it's all under control. But if it knocks you out and you're not there to wash the dishes at night and you're not there to be with the wife and the kids at night, so you're missing your Friday night. Now in the winter, that's a very important time to be with the family. I'm a big believer in games. All kinds of games. I came to someone's house last week, and I saw the two grandfathers sitting on the floor with a puzzle with the 5-year-old, 4-year-old building a puzzle with the kid. And I wanted to take a picture. I was scared they wouldn't be comfortable. It was so amazing to see two older men on the floor with a grandchild building a puzzle. Shabbos, it can be very meaningful if we're prepared for it. If we walk into Shabbos and we're dying to get that sleep, so then, I don't want to say the kids are a nuisance, but that might be how we're feeling when we really want to sleep. So if the schedule that a person is running is such that their prime time with the kids is really Shabbos, so then it would be a good idea to think how to prepare for Shabbos. I teach Thursday nights, many nights till 1, 2 in the morning at Machon Meir, and then I teach again Friday morning. But what people don't know is that I will very often spend Thursday, half a Thursday, sleeping, which I didn't used to do. But then I realized that if I don't get that sleep on Thursday, then by the time I come to Shabbos, I can't be there for the kids. So I invest on Thursday so that when I'm up Thursday night, I'll still be able to be with the kids Friday night and hopefully be the father they need. Shabbos comes in, we want to be patient. We could be patient. it involves a preparation. Saying when we realize this parent drew a picture that Shabbos is their time to be with the kids, okay? If that's the reality, so then I have to make the goal to be patient on Shabbos and to have real quality time. So that means a certain amount of preparation. Preparing books we can read the kids, preparing games we can play with the kids, whatever it is, it involves a certain amount of preparation so we can make it happen. Sometimes the correct thing is to say that kids can't have friends over on Shabbos. If that's the time you have with your kids, I remember once one of the kids said, this friend invited me for the Shabbos day meal. So we were feeling all guilty, and then we finally said, okay, you want to have the Shabbos day meal with that kid? So tell him to come here. So the kid said, no, his father would never let him miss a Shabbos meal with the family. So we were thinking, oh, but we're supposed to let him miss the Shabbos meal with the family, right? Sometimes that's the right thing, to say, no, you can't invite a friend, you can't go to a friend. If this is the time we have with kids, so... we have to make it into quality time, and that means we have to think in advance and plan so that we actually do have quality time. We're going to talk about with regards to one of the other questions, I think sibling rivalry. We're going to talk about family trips, but one of the concepts we've been speaking about is also creating positive times in the family. Meaning, it's a good idea to take advantage. I got a phone call 3-4 weeks ago that Rav Neventzal, will start with a phone call 2 months ago or a month and a half ago that Rav Steinman passed away. So I asked my wife, we coordinated, and I ran to the kids' school and I took them out of school and I took them all. Anyone who could understand that something big was happening, I took them all to the Levaya. They didn't understand. We sat in traffic for an hour and a half, 2 hours. I had to hire someone privately because there were no buses and there was nothing. So I had to pay a person to take us with his car. It cost us like 200 shekel to go to the Levaya. But I said to myself, I took the kids to Chacham Ovadia's Levaya and they remember it and it impacts them. And for the rest of their life, they'll remember they saw 500,000 people, whatever they saw, the Kavod HaTorah, the concept they gained, is something they'll have for life. So I said, okay, this is our investment in the children's chinuch. So I went and I took all the kids that we thought could gain something out of it, and they all went, boys and girls. We took everyone to Rav Steinman's Levaya. 2-3 weeks later, I got a phone call that Rav Neventzal is making a siyum on Shas. It's his, 30th, 40th, 50th siyum, and they decided to make a big deal out of it. So they invited a lot of people, and they brought a band, and they were surprising him. He didn't know. Usually when he makes a siyum on Shas, he takes a pack of cookies or something, and he makes a siyum on Shas. And this time, people got wind of it, and they decided they're going to make something nice. So they invited all the rabbanim of the old city, and they made a big deal. I took all the kids I could out of school, boys and girls. It's an experience. So it meant me taking off the day, them missing school, but it's something they'll remember their whole life. We should try to create positive events for our children, to create memorable events for our children, and to create quality family time. Now, sometimes people think that quality time means you travel to the Golan. And our bimba won't take us to the Golan, right? So that's not so easy to go up with the family to the Golan.
We're looking into a helicopter,
okay. Can seat so many people. Okay, at any rate. If a tick falls out of a helicopter, it's worse than a bimba. At any rate.
Good point. You have to rethink your plan.
It's like,
for kids, especially we're dealing with younger ages, if I go out to the garbage and Tuvia, 3 years old, is going to ask me, Abba, where are you going? I'm going to tell him I'm going on a tiyul. You want to come with me? So he goes, yeah. And I take his hand and we go out and I toss the garbage and then we come back and then I say, wasn't that a great tiyul? And he goes, yeah. And then I tell him, go tell all your siblings. And he goes and tells everyone, I went on a tiyul with Abba. Okay, that's his tiyul. We got onto this when some of the kids joined me. Mahon Meir goes on this big hike for Yom HaTzmaut. So some of the kids came with me. And the little ones, they also want to go on a tiyul. So we realized that they don't understand what a tiyul is. So he said, okay, let's go for a tiyul. Gave each one a hand. We went up the block. We went around the electric pole 2 or 3 times. And then we came back. I said, wasn't that a fun tiyul? Yes. Okay, good. So my point isn't to make fun of the kids. My point is that children's memorable tiyul doesn't have to be what we think is a memorable tiyul. We have to work with their concepts. We learned this from our neighbor, Rav Avishai Grosser. When their kids heard there's going to be a Medurah, a bonfire for Lag BaOmer, so they came home and said they want a bonfire too. So Rav Grosser said, fine. And he took 2 candles. Abdullah candle. He took it down to the entrance to the building. He put Abdullah candle. He stood it up. And right, it was a very late Lag BaOmer thing, so he stood it up, Abdullah candle, and they danced around it singing Bar Yochai. And the kids could come to school the next morning and said they had a fire and they sang Bar Yochai. And they were very happy. They didn't know the difference between. Right, but we're dealing with the younger ages. And my point is that when we speak about creating positive family time, it doesn't have to be something extravagant. It can be something very, very simple. A picnic to the park over here. For kids, that's meaningful. And part of it is making a big deal out of it. Our kids wanted tents, and they wanted to go hiking. So, I don't know if I have pictures here. We told them we can make tents on the porch. And they could really make a big deal out of it. And they spent hours creating tents on the porch. And we took old sheets. And for them, they had a tent. They had we took pictures. We let them make a picnic out there. Dinner was out in our tent. We tried to move as many activities as possible out to the tent. And for the kids, they had a blast. Do we need to go to the Golan and pitch a real tent? Till today, they're still talking about the tents they built and the trip they had with tents. So when we speak about creating positive times with the kids, it's very doable. And you can make anything into something fun. It's a question of what you're going to do. Sometimes it happens that I get surprised and I have to feed the kids lunch or supper. It can happen. So I don't know what I'm doing. So I tell the kids, we're going to make a really fun supper. That's my way for covering for the fact that I really don't know what I'm going to do with supper, right? So I say, we're going to do something great and special. So they get all excited. And then I say, okay, what are we going to put in the sandwiches? Because I don't know what I'm going to put in the sandwiches. But then the kids start coming up with, let's put this and let's put that and let's put the other thing, and we do it. And they walk away and they say, we had an amazing supper. Abba made a fun supper for us. Because I tell them in advance, and no, it's not chocolate spread and peanut butter. It's they have one or two real sandwiches before it gets to the chocolate spread sandwiches. My point is, we can and we should create special times with the kids as a family and as individuals. So when a parent says they have a very limited time with their kids, we can still, we spoke about the importance of bedtime. We spoke about making Shabbos meaningful. And now the idea of creating special events and creating times that are meaningful for the kids. Now, I don't know, again, who was asking the question here, but sometimes people have stages in life that are passing. A person is doing stage, a person is finishing their degree, a person has a passing job. Sometimes there are years in life. There can be a year or two where a person sees they have less time to invest with the family. To my mind, what's most important here, and this is after everything that's been said, this is something that women have to work on their whole lives, and that is to see the good in themselves, not to beat themselves up over it. There's a woman I know who spends years saying how this child, she had a job where she didn't have time to give that child the care that that child needed. I don't know. I don't think kids get scarred so easily. I think that if a parent has a year or two where they have to finish a degree, let's take it in stride and move on. That's reality, so we make the best of it. I don't think kids are going to get destroyed over such periods in life. There are times in life where parents have less time. That's a reality. So I think it's important that if it is a passing thing, not to make a bigger deal out of it than it really is. Let's take advantage of the things we can do and ignore the things that we can't do. You can't do it. You can't do it. My 5-year-old refuses to say brachos. Any type of encouragement and he totally shuts down. We don't know what to do. Should we just leave him be? Okay. So, as I said in the previous times, that everything I'm saying here, pretty much, my wife and I discussed, and basically this is what my wife told me to say. Unless it comes out wrong. Okay. So, maybe I'll begin with the story. Many parents find that their children go through stages where you're a little surprised that the kid is so rebellious at such a young age. So there are girls that when they get annoyed at their father, they'll pull down their skirt, blouse, whatever. You guys know what I mean. The blouse is the shirt? Okay, the skirt. Okay. And then there are boys that when they get annoyed, they're going to throw off their yarmulke, put it on the table. I think that there are two responses which are good. One is to ignore it, and the other one is to say, this one usually the fathers can do better than the mothers, leave it off, it's fine. When you get to Shemayim, don't get me involved. You know, you answer for yourself why you were without a yarmulke, but leave it off. That's at a certain age. I think 5-year-old that refuses to say brachos, then avoid the issue. I wouldn't force a kid to say brachos. what we do is we say it, and when the kid says it with us, they do. And when they don't, they don't. But we ignore it when they don't. So I know some of my kids don't bench. So I bench, and we try to do benching out loud, and those kids that don't. So sometimes I'll take the kid who I know is skipping most of benching or all of benching, and I'll put them on my lap and I'll say, let's bench together. I want to enjoy how beautiful you bench. or today I want everyone to hear your benching because you bench so beautifully. Working from the positive, not catching the kid and saying, hey, you didn't make a bracha. But on the contrary. So I think that it's when the children hear how we say the brachos out loud, so that's we're showing them by example. And when we give a child a cup of water and we make the bracha with them, and even if they ignore it initially, eventually they'll say it with us. And what I'll sometimes do with a kid is I'll say, Shakol niyeh, and the kid will say bidvaro, and I'll say very nice. You made a very nice bracha, and maybe next time you'll do more, and I'll do less. And the kid laughs, and then eventually they do more. There's a story of the Rebbe of Satmar, that a class was brought to the Rebbe of Satmar, and one boy was brought forward. I remember when I was a child, they also brought us to some Rebbe, and the Rebbe. The Rebbe usually would cut an apple and give each child. Now, if you're a chassid, so the Rebbe takes a bite and gives you a piece. If you're not a chassid, then the Rebbe doesn't take a bite. So we were not chassidim. But here, the Rebbe also understood. He put a fork in that apple and he gave the child an apple on the fork. And then the child was going to make a bracha. So he said, wait, stop. So the child's scared. What did he do wrong? I remember till today, that the Rebbe, I don't know which Hasidus this was that they took us to when I was a kid. I'm a lefty. The Rebbe gave us a slice of an apple, and I extended my left hand, and he wouldn't give me the apple. He was waiting for me to extend my right hand. Like, until today, I still remember that feeling of being embarrassed in front of everyone that he's not giving me the apple. Everyone else got a slice, and I didn't, because I extended my left hand until someone said to me, stick out your right hand, and then I got an apple. So these things that when kids go and visit a Rebbe, stays with them. It's a big experience for kids. And I recommend you find a way to do it. You take a kid to a tish. It's an experience. You know, there's something regal about going to visit a Rebbe. So the child was about to make a bracha. And the Rebbe said, 1 second. And then he said, I want you to know what's about to happen. You're going to make the bracha. So in Shamayim, they're all learning. There's a base medrash in Shemayim, everyone's learning. And when you're going to make a bracha, the Rebbein Shem's going to knock on the table and say, shh. David HaMelech, who's standing there singing Tehillim, he stops. Moshe Rabbeinu gives a shir in Torah, he stops. Everyone stops, and the Rebbein Shem's going to say, and then the Rebbe asks the boy, what's your name, Chaim? The Rebbein Shem's going to say, listen, Chaim's going to make a bracha. And when you finish the bracha, everyone in Shemayim is going to answer Ami. Moshe Rabbeinu, David HaMelech, everyone's waiting for your bracha. Okay, now make a bracha. Okay, now the child's holding his apple. It's a little bit more exciting. So I'm not saying you can do this with a five-year-old, but there are ways to make mitzvos meaningful to a kid in a positive way. Again, it's not about telling the kid, you messed up, Moshe Rabbeinu was listening. No, that's not what we said. So again, if we mention the idea that the Ribbon Shalom loves it when we make brachos, and when a child makes a bracha, you tell the kid, you know how happy the Ribbon Shalom is you just made a bracha, kol hakavod, and then you move on. The key here, I think, is not to make an issue of it. Be'emet, in the long run, it'll catch. If he sees everyone else doing it, he'll do it. I would not make an issue of it. Yes, part of chinuch is teaching them the habit and working with them. So there was a very scary story that happened this month. Not anyone that any of us know. I was brought as someone who's connected to the story, brought me into the story. But the story is of a couple where things were not going so great. And the wife told the husband, that's it, she wants to get divorced. And the husband said, okay. And so someone came to me and asked me to help them get the divorce. And I said, what does that mean? I don't know him. I don't know her. Why are they getting divorced? And he told me a story, which to my mind was regular Shalom bias. But I said, leave me out of it. I don't understand. I don't understand what's going on. So much to this man's mazel, his friends sent him to Rabbeim who knew him. And they looked at the guy and they said, so you had a difficult time in your marriage now and your wife said she wants to get and you just say yes? Doesn't work that way. Go to therapy, make it work. Why are you just right away saying yes? So the person who tried to bring me into the picture, I asked him, what's pshat? Why did the guy just say yes? How does that happen that she says, I want to get divorced, and he says, okay, and with that it's almost over. Thank God someone put the brakes on the story. So he told me that the guy has had the last 5 years, all the businesses he tried starting, everything he tried doing failed. And so he lost every iota of self-worth. And when his wife said she wants to get divorced, so he was thinking like, yeah, I can understand that. Why would you want to stay married to me anyways? So he just caved in. So what that story drove home to me was where we can get to if we don't see value in what we're doing. When a person feels like everything they're doing is not succeeding and everything they're doing is pointless, so then they have a very hard time holding on to anything. We all need to see value in what we do. That's what makes us want to do it. So this is true as adults. This is true specifically as mothers. Very often mothers are hard on themselves that they should have done this better. Why did I yell at the kids tonight? All kinds of things that people take themselves to task for. The most important person in a child's life is their mother, not their father. The person who really teaches a child about love and connection to Yiddishkeit and Torah, it's called Torat Imecha. So the same is true in a child. If what a child hears is they're fighting him over the bracha, he's going to have a hard time being interested in the bracha. But when a child can be shown value in something, and shown value is not a speech, it's just their bone shom's happy with what you did. Move on. So then the child will connect to what they see value in. It's normal if sometimes children need more time to be comfortable with certain mitzvot. Different children feel differently about different mitzvot. There are kids who don't like washing their hands in the morning. It's not always smart to fight the kids. Sometimes our job as parents is to turn a blind eye. Okay. There were two more. Yeah?
I'm just curious because I feel like, just in my own experience, that a lot of the mitzvot that I'm very comfortable with and very like on top of came from my parents, the ones that they're very comfortable with, and the ones that they were not so on top of or whatever, or still working on, those are the ones that I have trouble with. So is this just going to be me passing on the same issues to my children if I don't fight them on it? Like if, let's say, my problem is washing my hands in the morning, but I don't want to fight with my kids, so I just let it go, is that ever going to develop? Because
it's my issue and not really theirs, and they're still just growing on that? This question comes up in our generation with regards to minyan and davening and Ashkenazim and Sfardim. Sfardim connect to davening. You can see a Sfardi who doesn't even wear a yarmulke outside of shul, yet he goes to shul. And there are certain elements of tradition that Sfardim are very strong on. And it doesn't matter if a person's more observant or less observant. Like they'll say, Ani Shomer Kippur, right? Or people actually go to shul. And if you're talking about the Sfardim who are on a more observant level, so davening. And you walk into an Ashkenazi shul, the time has come to start davening. And there's an Amichai Hornstein there. But you don't have, I'm saying, you don't have a minyan. Comes the time for Baruch Hu, you have a minyan of people putting on their tefillin. You stay in Ashkenazi shul till the end of davening, and about 5 minutes before the end, you've lost 30 to 50% of your minyan. That's an Ashkenazi shul. Come to a Sephardi shul, 10 minutes before davening, you could see people doing Chok L'Yisrael. Right, they're there, their tefillin are on, their talis is on. It's like, you come to an Ashkenazi shul and there's a chasan there. So you cut out the tachanon, right? So all the Ashkenazim are smiling. You come to a Sephardi shul and you cut out tachanon, the Sephardim are troubled. What happened? They all want to know, why didn't we say tachanon today? Right? So there. You're Sephardi, right?
Yep.
Okay. So the to some degree, the Sephardim have this this attitude, which is so obvious to them, they give it over to their kids. It's not a fight. It's just this is what life is. You come to shul on time or early. On time means you're there 5 minutes beforehand and your towels and tefillin are on. And the kids accept it because it's really a part of them. Ashkenazim, they're not. It's not that way. And it keeps going on. And you see, the next generation is the same thing. It's very hard for them to change. It's interesting. You see it in shul also. There are those people who come early and you see their kids coming early. It's like, you see it. You see, there's something that that's a part of them. So there are definitely things which are a part of us, and then they become a part of the kids. And then there are things that are not a part of us. So what are we going to do? Start being hypocrites and fighting the kids when it's not really a part of us? I'm saying we can work on ourselves, and then it will hopefully it will move on to them. But when a person is, if a person is observing the mitzvah, they just don't connect to it. So they shouldn't give their negative feeling to the next generation. Meaning that's for sure. There are definitely people who keep Shabbat and they have a hard time keeping Shabbat, and they're hurting their kids if they tell them that. There are people who daven and they have a hard time davening, and they're hurting their kids if they tell them that. Meaning our attitudes we can hold on to. That really we don't have to give to their kids. There was a mother who told her daughter, I hated your grandparents. One of the grandparents just died, and at the shiva, the daughter-in-law said, "What a bloodsucker!" But they didn't give it to their kids. All those years, they didn't give it to the next generation. The kids only heard they have a great grandparents, and they never. The parent was able to hide it from the kid. So the kids saw a good relationship with in-laws, with parents, with grandparents, and I have a lot of respect for these people. When a person deep down inside, I was shocked, the shiva just ended. Like a day or two ago, it's not anyone from here. We're talking about someone from Chutzlitz. But I was shocked at how people can be such good people, that this is how they view their in-laws, but to the kids, they were able to give them a totally different perspective, and they gave them a gift, because the kids now have normal relationships with their in-laws. They don't view their in-laws this way, and they move on. I definitely think that when we speak about mitzvot that we observe, and the attitudes we give our kids, we can control what attitudes we give our kids. We can watch our mouth. We can be careful not to say negative things about all kinds of things that we know are our issue. That we can do.
Say a lukewarm attitude towards something harmful, then? If you just do it because you're supposed to do it without any feeling, is that also harmful?
So long as you don't tell them. I'm saying kids don't always catch our attitudes.
Tell.
Not on everything, no.
Like if you dive in and you're sort of like, whatever, it's a big deal. As opposed to a person who davens with feeling, you don't think that the children sort of pick up on that?
Sort of
like, as opposed to a different mitzvah that the parent might do.
But you can't give them what you don't have. I'm saying kids always, their starting point is the parent, and they have to grow from that.
They still see that.
Right.
They see it.
They also realize it's their fault that they don't see that you're not able to
make it, and then hope they catch on.
We just get to tell the kids I'm working on certain things. Because then it's not hypocritical, and I say, no, this is important, something mommy's working on.
Right.
And they will also learn as adults, there's still things you have to work on. Doesn't end just because you became an adult. So I feel like it saves me a lot. It does, because then they know it's important. So I say it's important, but I say it's something I'm working on.
Right.
I do that too.
I think everyone's worked up, but then saying the actual words is different.
Yeah, but I can't give them what I don't have. Tell my kids, don't learn from me on this.
I put my whole life and soul into chesed, but I'm like sort of iffy on something else. So won't they see the discrepancy between you?
I'll tell you, your
attention towards a certain mitzvah or a certain whole section of Torah and the way you relate to it. I don't know.
I have chavrusas.
I have a conversation about
school stuff. No. I have chavrusas that if we had to be friends, I couldn't stand sitting with them at a meal for more than 5 minutes. We are so different. We literally, I wouldn't have the patience to have 5 minutes of conversation with them, but we learn together. I have one chavrusa that were chavrusa over a decade. And one of the reasons I hold on to that chavrusa is because he has traits I need to learn from. And as far as my own avodat Hashem, I learn from people when I know they have traits that I don't have or that I'd like to have. And I think that one of the things we can give children is children catch on when we say we're impressed with someone else who has a midah. Meaning if when you go to shul, let's say the topic is tefillah, and a person feels like their tefillah is not great, but they say, you know, every time I see that person, I'm jealous. I wish I could daven that way. I gave them the value. I gave them the honesty that I'm not there. And I've given them the idea that I wish I were. I do that with my kids. I'm saying there are things I tell my kids. I say, look at Plony. Look at how beautiful they, A or B or C. Because I know it's something I wish I had. I'm not yet there. I think that's a way to give children a role model. And I find that the only way, I shouldn't say only, but in many areas the only way, that I can work on my midot is by seeing someone who has that midah. To me, that works much better than a book. When I see it in the flesh and blood, then I can try to work to be that way. And I think also children. You can develop in them an appreciation, and it doesn't have to be someone they see always. It can even be someone that they... my kids sometimes quote to me that I admired A or B or C. And I don't even remember who the person was. But they tell me, no, we had a guest who was kach v'kach, and you said that. Okay, say that. Are there other questions? Okay.
I have a question.
Yeah.
When kids tell on each other, on the one, I don't know if this was dealt with, so if it was, apologize. But on the one hand, there's the whole concept with Yosef and his brothers that he gave bad report. And I think there's an idea that we learn from that you're not supposed to be telling on each other. On the other hand, as a parent, on the one hand, you want to almost discourage this tattletaling. On the other hand, there are times where you sort of do need to know what's going on. So how do you find this right balance, and how do you try to give that balance to your kids of work it out, or I don't want to know, or don't be tattletaling? But there are times it does help to know what's going on if I'm not there.
So maybe we'll segue from sibling rivalry, from that into sibling rivalry, okay. Which was another question here. Let's rule out certain scenarios and then focus on the other scenarios. If two kids come to you and they're fighting, so they just brought you into the picture. You're the judge, you're the jury. So then, of course, it's not tattletale, right? There's no problem there. They brought it to you, which is fine. And if you feel like you should get involved, there's no question, you know. They came to you with a case. Obviously, they agree that they'll tell whatever they can tell. That's not a question. There's another rule, which I think it's important to tell kids, is that if something's not safe, so then their responsibility is to tell Abba and Ima. If something in here, it's wise to figure out what wording you use. You don't want to just say it's not safe. You want to use, Rabbi Horowitz has a whole thing on this, whether you're going to say if it feels wrong to you. You want to open up the idea that if someone touched them inappropriately, etc., they're going to talk to you. So I think another rule children have to know is that no adult can tell them to keep a secret from Abba and Ima. And no one older than them. It doesn't have to be an adult. Sometimes things happen with children who are not that much older, and most abuse happens. Most molestation happens with people who are close to the family. It can be a cousin, it can be an uncle. No one wants to think about that, but that's the reality. So you don't want to just tell them in adult, like there's this black monster out there who... you want to tell them if anyone older than you. No one older than you should be telling you to keep anything secret from the parents. And your responsibility as a child is, if you feel something is uncomfortable or not right, then you should tell Abba and Ima about it. And we'll never be upset at you for telling us that these are things a child has to hear. And they sink in. Again, you can look at Rabbi Horowitz's blog, you can buy his book. He's made it into the whole science of what to say and how to say. Fine, but the general theme is important. In Hebrew, datilumi, and in Hebrew, haridi. If you want your children to see pictures of people dressed like this or like that, it's very important, right? So, I did not see both of the books. I was amused that this is an important thing. Okay, so, an English is the only one. Okay, so we need to also develop in children the understanding that certain things they have to tell us. Anything that's not safe, that makes them uncomfortable, anything that has to do with an adult. Okay, so there we covered. I'm saying that. Okay, now we come to the bottom line, what's going on. So I think as a general rule, it's important to tell kids if it's not a safety issue. So why are you telling me? The exception is going to be when you start feeling that a child is being taken advantage of. It's not fair, child. We're going to get to that now in sibling rivalry. But I'm saying when we develop the rule that don't come telling me everything that happened, and if your brother is picking on you, work it out with him until you realize that it's past a certain point, and then you say, okay, let's deal. And then I think children also have to understand that as a parent, they can come to you. Remember, they're allowed to come and tell you. When a child comes and says, Chaim took cookies from the cookie jar, so then I think the answer is supposed to be, why are you telling me? Like, is it not safe? So of course, at some point, they'll tell you, yeah, I'm very worried about him. He's eating too many cookies, right? And then you're going to explain to them that that's not acceptable. So I think that's the direction we want to lead kids in, that if it's something that their brother's beating them up, so they need to tell you. So, okay, they're entitled to bring their fights to you. But if it's just something that it's not unsafe and it's not, and it's just really saying bad about their sibling, so I think our reaction teaches them that sensitivity when they say it. And my father had a rule, which I also follow up on, that if a kid tattletailed on another kid, if a kid said, you know, Chaim took a cookie from the cookie jar, so then the reaction was, thank you for telling me, Chaim, come have another one. The child would get rewarded, the one who was tattletailed on. So the one who tattletailed didn't benefit from it. Meaning, I remember I was begging my parents to get an Atari. I don't know if any of you know what that is. That's the prelude to the Wii, Y, whatever that's called. I don't know how you pronounce that, yeah? So before Nintendo and before Game Boy and before all of that, there was this thing with a joystick called Atari. And my parents refused. And then once I was begging them to get it for Afikoman. And one of my siblings interfered and started arguing that I shouldn't get it. And my father said, this afternoon you're getting it. And that's when I got it. Because all my arguing didn't get me to the point where one brother spoke out against me. So my father said, no, if you're speaking against your brother, now he's going to get it. And then I got it. Much to my whatever. I'm not so sure that was a good move, but at any rate, I'm saying I think then you teach children the idea that you're not going to back them, they're not going to benefit from speaking negatively. And I think they do learn that sensitivity when it's appropriate, when not. When they see your reaction, when they see that if it's a safety issue, you get involved. If they're suffering, you get involved. But if it's shtuyot, then you're not going to back them, and they might even lose by getting you in the picture. I think that's, is that clear enough?
Yes. Except I'm still processing.
Okay.
It's so much easier to kids keep us on our toes.
It's just different way of thinking about it.
I'm saying they're...
But it frees you. You have to have to be the referee all the
time. Yeah. You don't have to be the referee all the time. It has to be worth putting you in the picture.
Just the only side I'm thinking about is, on the one hand, I agree that I understand that if a child's going to tattletale, then it almost encourages the tattletale when you go after the child. But on the other hand, it can also tell the kids that mommy's, as long as mommy's not looking, it doesn't matter who else is looking, because I can do what I want. As opposed to if they know that maybe their siblings are looking, then they still sort of need to rein themselves.
But I don't want that. I don't want them to rein themselves in because their siblings are looking. I don't want my children to be the policemen of their siblings. On the contrary, even when the older siblings tell me, if they tell me a younger sibling was jumping off a cliff, something that happened, I'm saying it's really happened. One of the older kids came and told me a kid jumped off a cliff. Okay, I need to know that. That's important, right?
They refused to do it.
Now he doesn't have a big brother to tell us.
He tells us.
Okay. If a kid's climbing to the roof, so yeah, then it's not that he's overseeing him, even though if he could stop him, he should. He has to tell me because it's safety. But if it's not safety, I don't want my kids to be policing the other kids. No. And you know what? Kids will get away with things, and that's fine. So sometimes they'll eat nachos you didn't mean for them to eat, and sometimes they'll do all kinds of shtuyot which you didn't mean for them to do, and that's going to happen. So if we come to terms with that, and we realize that, so fine. I feel that we lose much more if I've created a situation where kids have to watch their back. And I always tell my kids, you're supposed to want your brother to succeed. You're not supposed to be there to get him in trouble. He did something wrong. Okay, if it's not a safety issue, then why would you want your brother? You should want him not to get into trouble. The school once told the kids that if the kids in the younger grade get into a fight and a kid in the older grade, their sibling in the older grade interferes, they're going to get into serious trouble. And I called my kids over and I said, you better be willing to get into trouble. But if you see your younger sibling being beaten up and you turned away because the school said something, oy vavoy to you. How could you ignore your sibling? And I called the Rebbe and I said to him, you should know, if you guys want to get him in trouble, you get him into trouble. But my chinuch is that if a kid sees his brother in trouble, he better go and help him. And if you guys want to get in trouble, do what you want. And the Rebbe said, I'm with you. At least the Rebbe made sense, right? Kids have to know they're supposed to be there for their siblings. I told the kids, you will not, don't turn a blind eye to your brother. I don't care what the school said. Your job as a sibling is to be there for them. Ah, he's eating a cookie he shouldn't be eating. Why are you telling me? You're not doing it because you're there for them. So be there for them. I think that's much more important for the kids to learn to be there for them. Okay, sibling rivalry.
Can I just ask a little? Yeah. Time the kids to differentiate
what's safety and not safety.
Yeah.
Look, they're kids, but often they'll know. Most of the time they'll know, and you'll also tell them. I think most of the time they know. Most of the time they know. What? Most of the times they know, and also you'll teach them. I'm saying sometimes something will happen and I'll tell the kids, why didn't you tell me? Your job is a sibling, you should have come and told me. And I'll tell them. Yeah?
Just another spin-off of this question. When it comes to things like a kid pulling their hair, poking them, bothering them, taking things from them. So my thing usually is to try to have them work it out themselves. But I'm starting to notice sometimes as a child's a little bit more dominant. So where do you find that balance in a situation like that?
We'll get to that, yeah.
When to let them work it out, when to step in so that someone's not being hurt in the process, or when they have to learn how to stand up for themselves and work.
So that, okay, you asked three different questions.
Okay.
Let's...
Sorry.
No, it's okay. I'm saying no. So in terms of standing up for themselves, so I've had many times with my kids where I saw that they were not standing up for themselves and I had practice runs with them. Where I would play, I would teach them, I would tell them, I'm going to hit you now. I'm the kid in school who's going to hit you. You better defend yourself. And the kid doesn't even know what to do. They're standing there like this. And I go, pick up your hands. Let's go. We're going to learn how to block someone when they're hitting you. You have to learn how to do this. And I've done this with more than one kid where we had trial runs, like sparring matches, where I'll come slowly with my hand. I say, pick up your hand, block it, block it. You're going to get hit. Block my hand. Don't let someone just hit you. So that's definitely a part of chinuch, where kids have to learn to defend themselves. And the halacha says, not only haba lehorgecha shkem lehorgo, but also haba lehazikcha. If someone's coming to harm you, so you're supposed to stand up first and make sure they don't. So that for sure, kids have to learn. In terms of kids working it out themselves, so I think that very often it's good to ask them the question, Why do you need me in the picture? Can't you work this out yourself? And very often, if you tell the kids, I don't have time now. We'll talk in 10 minutes. In 10 minutes, it's not an issue anymore. Very often, by just pushing them off, they do work it out themselves. And I don't believe we should always be telling them the line, work it out yourself. It's a good line to say sometimes, but it's better to create that reality. If I can just push it off, so then very often, within 5 minutes, they don't have an issue. If I tell them, I'll be happy to deal with it, come back to me in 10 minutes. In 10 minutes, look at the clock in 10 minutes. Almost always, they won't come back in 10 minutes. Almost always. That's sometimes you see a kid is taking advantage of another kid, or they're always succeeding. We'll get to that in a second. That's in sibling rivalry. Okay. Sibling rivalry. Okay. So sibling rivalry has become this central theme in Western discussions and books. And it's as though having a sibling is a challenge because there's going to be sibling rivalry. And that's not true. The first thing we have to realize is kids can be the best friends of their siblings and also have sibling rivalry. And that's normal. It's a part of life. Enjoy. What can you do? It's reality, you know. If anyone thought they could get married and never fight with their husbands, then they don't know what marriage is all about. It's not going to happen. If you think you could have kids and not have sibling rivalry, it's not going to happen. Marriage is worth it in spite of the difficulties, and so is it worth it for kids to have siblings in spite of the rivalry. The fact that there's going to be rivalry, there will always be rivalry. It's a part of the fact that they're both growing up and each one is trying to get their space, and the older one is looking at how they can take advantage, exploit the younger one, and that's normal, and it's not the end of the world. We'll get to that in a second. If you look at only children, so very often they're miskinning. The children who have no siblings will very often grow up a pretty dismal childhood because they're all alone. So we have to realize that we're giving the child a gift when we give them a sibling. The fact that sibling rivalry exists is a reality of life. We'll deal with it. Children can be friends and also have sibling rivalry. And our attitude has to be, I've given them a gift in the fact that I've given them siblings. That's very bad when people have this attitude, oh no, I did something bad for them, I gave them siblings. That's a mistake. Children are lucky to have siblings. Now, even when siblings fight, it's a gift to have siblings. Sometimes children have different natures. I have a brother that my parents used to say they couldn't leave us alone at home because when they'd come home, one wouldn't be alive. They'd have one child less. And they weren't exaggerating. I would have been the alive one? Maybe. but our personalities are so different, that as children, we couldn't get along. I mean, it was a rivalry that my mother couldn't give us a bath together. Imagine having two little kids and you can't leave them in the bath together because you're not sure you're going to find them both alive. In the end, my parents put us on two extremities of the house. Like and you're talking about little kids. I mean, I remember once my brother made a sign for every person in the family. For this one, he wrote Bright and Lego. For this one, he wrote Bright and Stamps. Everyone, their different hobbies. And I didn't get one, right? And it was a shtuch, like, okay, so you're not Bright in anything, right? It was like ongoing until we were much older. And my mother would always tell us, you don't have to get along. It's fine. Just do me a favor, call one another Erev Rosh Hashanah and wish one another Shana Tova and be decent to one another. Maybe you live on two different parts of the planet. That's fine. You'll be, but that's the exception. Most siblings are not like that. Most sibling rivalry is not that. A situation where personalities are so different that they really can't get along is exceptional. That's not what usually happens. It's not what should happen in most homes. And I can tell you that today, this brother and I are probably the closest, to the point where everything, before he got married, we sat down together, and if I come to the United States, I'll fly across the United States for us to spend Shabbos together. He's got a wife and kids and everything, and we have an amazing relationship. But it could only happen when we were older, when we could give one another the space. I remember once he came to visit me in yeshiva, and I gave him in my room, and I was climbing the walls. Once we were together in the same room, I was already maybe 20 or more. He was already older, and I couldn't be in the same room with him. But I didn't say a word. I was old enough to know we're different, and we had an amazing time together. I just didn't spend any time in the room. I literally would come in and sleep and leave. I wouldn't be in the room because to be so close didn't work for our personalities. But that's the exception. It's not what usually happens, and it's not what should usually happen. Most of the time, sibling rivalry is simply because they're siblings and they're friends and they're close, and so sometimes they're going to get on one another's nerves and sometimes not. And it's a positive, normal part of childhood. What my reality with my brother until we were in our teenage years is not what should really be in most homes. It's not what you're seeing with your kids. It's rare. It's not common. I'm saying most of the time it's not a personality issue. It's not that their personalities don't jive. It's that they're kids and they're normal and they're normal siblings. And normal siblings will fight and they'll be at peace and they'll fight and they'll be at peace. And that's fine. Do we have to get involved? Most of the time not. Children, when they have siblings who are close to them in age, love the idea that they have someone to play with. One of the mistakes American parents make is that they think they have to entertain the kids. You don't have to entertain kids. Give them what to entertain themselves with. If you give them the tools, it could be a box, it could be a pot, it could be a broken fan, a broken alarm clock. The kids can entertain themselves for hours and play together. And the fact that they're different, they'll make it work. And the fact that they'll fight, that's normal. Kids fight, and then they play again together, and then they fight again. Should you get involved when they have a fight, realize that you almost always don't know the full story. Unless you were there from the beginning, and even then they'll tell you what happened yesterday, realize that you don't really know the full story. One of the mistakes that parents make is they think they know. That's mistake number one. Mistake number two, they're quick to react. Mistake number three, people think that the one who's winning, he's the one that's wrong. Maybe right now he's beating up his brother. You know, Hevel was on top of Cain. Cain started up with Hevel, and then Hevel got the upper hand. And he was sitting on him, and he was ready to kill him. And then Cain said, "I'm your brother, don't kill me." So Hevel said, "Okay," and he let him go. And then Hevel walked away, and Cain pounced on him and killed him. So who was in the right, and who was in the wrong? Cain started the fight, but Hevel was able to get the upper hand. So that's what the pasuk says. Vayakom Cain el Hevel achi vayargeu. Cain was able to get back up and kill Hevel. Why was he getting back up? Because initially Hevel won the fight. So sometimes parents automatically think that the one who won the fight, who's sitting on top and pinning his brother down, he's the one that's wrong. Not necessarily. Another mistake parents make is they think the one who's crying is the one who deserves to be defended. That's not at all true. Some children just turn on the faucet, especially if they know that it'll move mommy. So we have to be very careful if we're going to get involved. One of the mistakes parents make is that they take their concept of fairness and they apply it to children. So let's take the following example. Two children come home from school. They both got a cupcake. The older one finished his cupcake and convinced the younger one, "You want to give me your cupcake. You know what? If you give me your cupcake, I have this screw. You're going to have a really great time with this screw. In 5 minutes, the cupcake will be gone, but the screw you'll have for a lifetime. You could put it on top of your bed and under your bed and see what holes it goes into. And the younger one takes the screw and they're enamored by the screw. And you're watching this as a parent and you're thinking, that's not fair. So now you're going to make a mistake and get involved. Why get involved? It could very well be that the younger one is going to walk away so happy with their screw. They're going to really be happy for an hour with that screw and they really got something good. But you as a parent understand that the older one really took advantage and exploited the younger one. Who cares? If the younger one's happy and the older one's happy, so good for the older one. It's very good that the older one learned how to maneuver things in life and manipulate their younger sibling. And if their younger sibling walked away happy, so all's fair. The problem becomes when grandma comes and brings gifts for all the kids and the older one ends up with everyone's gifts and everyone ends up with screws, right? You know this, right? This screw is amazing, right? Every kid ends up with a screw and the older one ends up with everyone's gifts. What? If they're very lucky, right? Maybe they'll all get one screw, right? Depends on how... So that's where parents have to get into the picture. When the kids end up feeling like that wasn't fair, when the child starts saying, hey, I don't have any gifts, all my toys belong to my older sibling, I can't even go on my bed, right? We reached a point where the older one owned the whole room, right? That's the machlokas kain and hevel. They couldn't even go into their beds, right? So then you sort of have to get into the picture. But the idea that in our concept, the older one exploited the younger one, it's not bad. So the older one learned how to manipulate. Yes, it's manipulative. We're all manipulative. And there's nothing wrong with that. Over time, they'll learn the concept of fairness. They'll learn the concept of compassion. And I wouldn't make an issue of this, so long as the younger one is happy. And very often, the younger one is happy. It's us that get very upset when we see what happens. If we want children to develop positive relationships together, so part of the way to do that is to play with them, to have games where everyone's playing, to have Shabbos party where everyone's a part of Shabbos party, to have trips to the park where we all go. Shabbos can be a time for togetherness. Sometimes it's a good idea to make a rule that on Shabbos, there's no complaining about your siblings. If children know that on Shabbos, they're not going to get away with complaining about their siblings, so then the Shabbos table can be different. Some Shabbos tables, the kids are busy updating the parents on what they hold against, what grudges they have. And this is what we mentioned earlier also, family trips, that they build togetherness. When we made a mangal in the summer, mangal was a big deal. The kids would all go collecting pieces of wood. I wouldn't buy charcoal. They collected the wood. This was their fun. So we created the charcoal. So it's a whole afternoon event making a mangal. It's not just the mangal. It's a whole event. One of the issues with sibling rivalry is sometimes created by the parent themselves. Sometimes it's only fair to give all the kids the same thing. You're making a Shabbos party. Everyone's getting bamba, so everyone should get bamba. Everyone's getting pretzels, everyone should get pretzels. There's an equality and a child is correct in expecting it. But sometimes you have a kid that's not reading and you're going to give them rewards for reading. You have a kid that needs help in toilet training. So you're going to give them a raisin every time they go to the bathroom. And the other kid says, but when I go to the bathroom, I don't get a raisin. So parents can get uptight and make the mistake of saying, okay, you'll get a raisin too. And that's a mistake. It's important to teach children that if one kid needs braces, that doesn't mean another kid needs braces. That's what my mother-in-law used to tell her kids. When kids used to say, how come he's getting that and I'm not? So my mother-in-law would tell them, they're getting braces. You want braces too? Their teeth need braces. Yours don't. We give the children what they need. And this is a concept that children can understand. So long as we're fair in times that we're giving things that it's legitimate that every child should get the same thing, so then children can also understand that this child now needs chizuk in going to the bathroom, so I'm giving them a prize for it. This child needs chizuk in reading, so I'm giving them a prize for that. Here, parents have to learn to teach the children the concept that you don't have to be jealous. This is their need, and they're getting what they need, and so on. Sometimes parents cause jealousy and sibling rivalry with compliments. You have to be careful when you're complimenting a child. If you know that one child takes very good care of the younger siblings and the other one does not, it's a correct sensitivity not to praise that child. You're going to tell the grandparents, you know, Shloimi is very good with the little ones. And then they're going to ask you, and how is Esti? And you're going to say, well, that's not fair. That's not fair. There you're causing the jealousy. So we have to pay attention to the compliments we're going to say. If we're going to praise a child, and children need praise, we should be able to praise where we can praise equally and not create a situation where children feel that inequality. Oh, he's better than me. The same is true with criticism. If I have an issue I have to deal with one of the kids, very often I'll take them to their room alone. I won't do it in front of the other kids. A child appreciates that respect, that they weren't criticized in front of everyone. They did something wrong. Okay, it's no one else's business. Why? If children will sometimes egg on a child or make fun of a child or try to listen and say what they did wrong, so they should be told that that's not right. It's a good idea to find what to praise each child. An example of that is, let's say, Friday night. You want your children to help prepare for Shabbos. So it's a nice idea on Friday night when you sit down for the meal to start saying thank you to this one for peeling the vegetables and thank you to that one for putting away the groceries and thank you each one for what they helped. As we praise, we encourage them to do positive. And it's good to give focused compliments. And here I want to touch on something just, it's come to my attention that this is very difficult for parents and I don't know why. One of the issues that parents keep complaining about is that their children, as they grow, they don't mature. The children today are very immature. And I always ask the same question, how much responsibility do you give your kids? And usually parents say, oh, nothing. They're immature. How could I give them responsibility? And I say, no, it's the other way around. Give them responsibility, they'll mature. This is true at every stage. We should challenge the kids. A child of 5-year-old can take the bag of apples and put them away. You might get a little bit smushed up apples. They might not notice the rotten apple on the bottom and it'll stay there. That's a price. Okay, but we have to find what works within our day and give children real responsibility. And this is true from a very young age, and the more you give them, the more they will mature and they will grow. It's very important that children get compliments for what they've done right. Now, this can be about anything. It can be about putting on their shoes. It can be about putting on their socks. It can be about changing their undergarments today. Whatever was a challenge for this child, so that when I compliment them for doing it, I'm helping them continue to do it. And again, children can do. One of the reasons children don't grow is because we don't expect them to. Having expectations. Criticism has to be focused. Don't tell a child you're a slob. You could tell a child, I'd like you to make your bed. When a child has a friend over, should you let their siblings play with them, or does that cause sibling rivalry? So again, as a parent, we shouldn't project our concerns to the children. Sometimes the children are perfectly fine playing with that sibling. You have dominant siblings that if they're there, they'll destroy it and they'll take away the friend from them. But sometimes it's not that way. It's only our concern. So it pays to pause and let the children work it out themselves. Don't assume that the child needs that space. Very often we assume that. I was surprised. Many times I'd offer a child, do you want to come with me to the makolot? We'll take a trip together. And the child says, yeah, but only with a sibling. So I was offering the child alone time with me. And the child wants to be with a sibling. And it was very enlightening to me how much I would project to the children. I thought the child needed time alone with me. And the child was saying, no, I'm perfectly happy. I'll be happier taking a sibling along. So I'm saying here, we as parents have to be open to that and not project our concerns to the children. If they bother them, okay, so then you have to let the child enjoy with their friend alone. There are 1, 2, 3 more questions we didn't get to. You choose which one. Number one was, number one was the daughter who calls her parents and siblings chatzuf. How should they deal with it? Number two was how to say no effectively. And number three was somewhere here. I'm not finding it. How much should people space their children? Something like that. Okay, how many people want the one about child calling parents chatzuf? How many people want the one about how to say no effectively? Okay. I guess that one won. Okay. And the other one, I don't know where it is. Okay. Ah, it's here. No, it's not. Okay. How to say no effectively. Okay. Rule number one, if you're ready to be a parent, be prepared to repeat yourself. Point number two, we shouldn't always say it. Sometimes we should create the reality. You want to leave the park. And the child says, no, I want to stay. So one of the things I like to do is to tell the children 2 minutes in advance that we're leaving. I tell them, I want you to choose the rides you're going to do and have the most fun you can, because in 2 minutes we're going. I feel like it gives the children much more of a sense of control. It's not that I just showed up the big bad Abba and said, done, we're leaving. On the contrary, I very often try to tell them in advance, in 5 minutes we're going to have to go. Choose the rides that are best and go enjoy them, because in 5 minutes we're going to have to go. And I find that very often, just that introduction helps the children that when the time comes, they can go. Sometimes it's good to tell children, look, we can leave now, or we can stay another 5 minutes, but then in 5 minutes you have to help me clean up really quickly and not make a fight about going. So that also works often. But we should be prepared to create the reality that the children say no, and we don't stand there begging them, yes, please come, but rather when a child is 4, 5, and 6, it's fine to say, give me your hand, we're going. And they're going to give the hand, and we're going. They don't always have to agree. One of the rules they taught us in educating youngsters is that children respond much better to positive commands than negative commands. So if you want the children on the sofa and you don't want them to come off of the carpet because you just washed the floor. So our natural inclination is to tell children, please don't come on the floor. But children will understand much better if you tell them, can you please stay on the couch for the next 3 minutes? I want you to stay on the carpet. Then you say, and I don't want you to come forward, but I want you to stay on the carpet. The positive is something they understand much better than the negative. Instead of saying, I don't want you to come to the room now, I'm working, you could say, I want you to play in the living room now, and I'll tell you in 5-10 minutes when we can talk. Giving them the positive is a much better, much more effective than the negative. A child says, Mommy, can I color now? So you can say no, but you can also say, now we're eating dinner. So you've explained what yes. Then the no is inconsequential. Very often, we are focused on getting the child to understand the no, whereas we can get them to understand the yes. If a child says, can I eat this treat now? And we say no, then our focus is, he wants yes, and I said no. However, if I say, we're saving that treat for Shabbos, so I've given the child the no without saying the word no. And very often, that's something which a child can deal with much better. I want to distinguish here between the mistake that many people in our generation make, which is they're begging and trying to get the child to understand. To say, no, don't eat the treat, because we want it for Shabbos, so then my no has become, I'm going to explain it to you, I hope you understand. Where what I'm saying is, the no is not the main point. Let the no be not even said. This treat is, we're saving for Shabbos, you take it, you put it in the closet, the no just became a reality. My point is not that the parent should feel like I owe the child an explanation. If I were a good parent, they'd understand. Of their own accord, they wouldn't want to eat the treat. That's not going to happen. However, what we're trying to accomplish here is accomplishing the no by creating the no without making it a power struggle. I said, no, they want yes, and now it's a power struggle. So we discussed, A, you're going to have to repeat yourself. B, sometimes you have to act it, don't say it. The idea of taking a child from the park, the idea of giving them time in advance. Thirdly, we discussed the idea that instead of saying you can't color now, to say now we are eating dinner, the idea that sometimes you can guide things without having to say the no. And finally, the idea that children understand directives or commands that are positive much better than the negative. Okay, Yeshua Koach. Yeshua Koach to everyone.